We get things underway by welcoming back to the program an actor, author, storyteller. It's not for me to say he's our favorite guest because, well, you have decided it. He's the reigning Downtown Madness champion, the only two-time winner. We're so happy to welcome back Stephen Tobolowsky. Hello, Stephen.
Well, hello, Rich. I'm very happy to be here. And I thought if I won that award for Downtown, I was supposed to get a big old shiny belt like the wrestlers got. Did you send that? Because I never got that.
Oh,
that
gosh. Belt. Well, you know, the mail has been a bit disrupted because of COVID.
Everybody's blaming COVID these days, but I expect to see that shiny belt before I lose it this year.
See, now you want, Bryan Cranston wanted a trophy when he won. You want a belt. Well, I'll tell you what, when you come back to Bangor, when you and Ann are back here, we'll have a belt for you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
What's been going on? What have you been up to during these interesting times?
Gosh, well, so the studio's pretty much closed down around Thanksgiving, except for Goldberg's. So over at Sony Studios, I've done about 6 of the Goldberg shows, one of which had a COVID crisis. Wendy and I were doing a scene one afternoon, and the ADs run on and said, "There's been a COVID break in the studio, a COVID break in the studio." I have no idea what that means. He says, "Everybody out of here, everybody out of here." It was like some sort of air raid drill. So we run outside. And we're all huddled together, which seems like we're not social distancing in our terror. And then the AD says, "Everybody go home, and we'll call you at home and tell you what all this means." So it was a very unpleasant car ride home. And then we found out that one of the stand-ins had COVID. And so what they had to do was get everybody off of the stage, decontaminate everything. And then Wendy and I came back the next morning and finished the scene. And it got me thinking as to what a professional actor is. Like, I run into people all the time who want to be actors. This last show we did, which had no COVID break in it, I had a call time of 6 in the morning, which meant I had to wake up at about 4:15. And drive to the studio, get my makeup and everything. Yeah, I don't have to worry about my hair getting done. They just kind of polish the top of my head. And we get up, we start rehearsing at about 6:50 in the morning. They set up the cameras. We start shooting about 7:15, 7:20. And I'm thinking, this is kind of what a professional actor is. They don't teach this in the schools. You know, they teach you animal exercises and mirror exercises. And what you really have to do to be a professional actor is you have to be able to do a comedy scene when there is a COVID emergency and you run out, then you have to come back and finish that scene in the morning. You have to do a comedy scene at 7:20 in the morning. You have to be funny. And then I had a second scene the next day in which I had to perform with asses, real asses. And I think I can't differentiate between donkey or ass. It was real donkeys or asses. I'm from Texas, so I'm familiar with asses. And Mary Lambert was our director. She's from Arkansas. She's very familiar with asses. And so,
now Stephen, would they be considered dangerous animals back in the days of the Dangerous Animals Club?
What I know about horses and what I know about donkeys, they would very much be considered dangerous, especially if you're doing comedy with them. So the stage people kept trying to move the asses closer to me. So I got the rear end of one ass about 3 feet away from me and the head of the other ass about 3 feet away from me. And I had this, I'm supposed to come out of my office as Principal Ball and be very upset. And I go, "Donkeys, donkeys, this is a school, not a trip down the Grand Canyon." So I'm supposed to come out of the office and do this, but I know, being familiar with horses and asses, that if I come out and I say that to that donkey that's facing me, the donkey who wasn't facing me was going to kick me.
Right.
You know, so as a professional actor, you have to know how to get your lines across without getting murdered by asses kicking you to death in a pretend school hallway. That's part of being a professional actor, too.
That's not the kind of thing Uta Hagen ever talked about.
No, no. And it makes you rethink your whole life. Like, what am I doing here? You know, what? Why am I still doing this? But it is. I've been doing that, which has been lovely. I've been sitting in the yard. Our garden loves the pandemic. Our garden absolutely loves it for whatever reason, and things have been growing beautifully. Anne has been cooking a lot. I don't know. Our last visit, the pandemic had begun, I believe.
Yes.
But and did we discuss my diet, what my diet
had
become?
We talked about the fact that you were eating a lot of homegrown food.
And Anne is baking, so I begin every morning with homemade sweet rolls,
right.
Cinnamon rolls. We have homemade, now she's gone into sourdough bread, so homemade sourdough bread. We have muffins, what she calls lemon pancake muffins, and so I eat this from about 6:30 in the morning to about 3 in the afternoon. I eat muffins and cinnamon rolls, and then I start drinking gin at about 4 o'clock. And that carries me through the rest of the evening. And guys, I have lost about 15 pounds.
Wow.
So I'm thinking I may be onto another book here. The Tobolowsky COVID diet book. People would kill to, and I'm not sure why I've lost the weight, but again, Anne is cooking things from the garden as well. I think it's we eat so much less than going to restaurants.
Mm.
Maybe that's it, that the amount of food we're taking in is so small, even though the amount of food we're taking in is sourdough bread and fresh-made cinnamon rolls. Oh, my gosh, they're so good. We have coffee with cats in the morning. That's a routine that the cats actually began. So we fill up the coffee at about 6:15. I load up with the cinnamon rolls, and Anne and I head to the den, and then the cats arrive, and they demand to be petted. And Anne and I sit, like civilized people, across from one another, and we discuss what we're going to do with our day, which usually is nothing. We have nothing really planned. That's the odd thing about the pandemic is – there's nothing to do, but you still can't get it done.
Yeah, that's for sure. We're talking.
There's no way. And we have coffee with cats, and then we're talking about starting wine with felines.
Oh yeah.
Later in the afternoon, when I'm drinking gin. So, I don't know if gin and wine mix, but we'll find out. That's the next thing we're planning for the pandemic.
We're talking with Stephen Tobolowsky here on Downtown. Now, you've been doing some virtual theater, you and Anna, with the Road Theater Company, and some wonderful productions that you've both been involved in, and keeping those creative juices flowing. And I'll tell you, the arts community nationwide has really stepped up. It's been a challenge, but finding ways to keep doing wonderful things, entertaining the audience, but also doing what you do.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's so difficult. We've been involved with a new play festival in which Anne has been, I think she directed two of the plays. I was in one of them. And out of, I think there were about 30 plays of new plays. Then there was what they called the Road Theaters Under Construction Festival. This was a group of, I believe, like about 10 plays that were still in the process of being written, in which I participated as an actor in one of them, and Anne also directed. And now, oh man, this is really stepping it up to a new level. Anne is directing Steve Yawkey's play Reykjavik, which is a wonderful, extraordinary play, but they're going to take it a step further, as opposed to just doing it on Zoom, which to me is like looking at security cameras at a department store. But it's like, you know, you're watching this play on Zoom. they're really going to go into the theater. This is all with COVID protocol, tons of COVID protocol. They're going to, you know, the theater is going to be cleaned out. The actors are going to be on stage and they're going to rehearse with masks on, with shields. They're going to bring in a professional film crew. In fact, Robert Brinkman, who did Stephen Tobolowsky's Birthday Party, is going to be our DP with Andy Pozoigel, who was our producer on Stephen Tobolowsky's Birthday. They're going to come in with their cameras, their camera operators, and in the theater, they're going to film a real theatrical performance. In other words, the actors have learned their lines. They're not reading their lines on the screen. They're going to be interacting. They're going to be kissing. They're going to be fighting. They're going to do everything that happens in this play with strict COVID protocols, and that all the actors are going to be tested like every other day, like we do on Goldberg's. Everybody's going to be tested. Everybody is going to be quarantined so it's safe, and then we're going to film it. And they're going to put that out, and that will be the next step. You know, people ask me all the time, you know, what's going to happen with theater? Because we see how tough it is with movies. With people going to movies, are they going to sit 6 feet apart? The question is, what are you going to do with theater when the people sitting next to you? You can't have them 6 feet apart and really have a theater audience. What play are you going to go see Importance of Being Earnest before the world is safe again? I don't think so. What theatrical experience is going to get you to take that kind of chance? And I think I take my hat off to all of these writers, directors, all the people creating the sets, all the technicians working at Zoom at the Rode Theater, and all these other theaters, they are struggling to keep it going.
Right.
I feel like sometimes we're in Lord of the Rings and we're just trying to light the bonfires to say, come on, we got to just keep it going for a little while longer before it dies out, because I just don't know how and when it's going to come back to normal.
By the way, we love the new season of the Tobolowsky Files. It's hard to pick a favorite, but gosh, they were all so great this year. I think it was my favorite season, and I love the way you and David structured it so we got something brand new every week.
Yeah, that's another thing the pandemic was good for, was for writing. And David made me stop at 16. Because I was still going. And he said, Tubbo, let's just get these out there. Let's just finish these. So I was able to write and record the stories on my own during the pandemic. Then I send them to David. And then David and I, together, we do the intros and outros. And David edits together. I send David the music. He edits the music into the show. And we were able to stay ahead of the chainsaw. I always viewed the Tobolowsky Files as a form of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie, in which David Chin is Leatherface. Sorry, David. And I am Marilyn Burns running from him in the forest. And because I had to get a new story out every week. And we did that. Oh, gosh, Rich. We did that for like, I want to say about 40 episodes in a row. We did one episode a week that I was writing, recording, getting it out there and writing. This time I was able to write, and it also helped me in writing in that, not panicking, I was able to create more of a kind of structured, unstructured through line for this season.
Right.
In a way, sort of based around that Carl Jung book I read that absolutely freaked me out. And I don't know if it's too much of a tease or too much of a bore. Should I mention what that was?
Oh, yes, please.
Yeah, it was. So Carl Jung, you know, he was a companion of Sigmund Freud and sometimes a competitor. And I guess he was big in 1900s, 1920s, 1930s. Anyway, in 1933, he went to see a gallery display of artwork done by the alchemists, by various alchemist scientists and artists in the 14th, 15th, and 16th century, right? So we're talking about 13, 14, 1500s, right? We're in 1933. And Jung is shocked when he goes into this art exhibit, and there on the wall, he sees these mystical paintings. He sees a painting that is the exact replica of a dream that one of his patients told him that week while they were on the couch. So how is it that this dream could reflect something that was done as a work of art that this person never saw? The client never saw these antique works of art. And I'm reading this story. And then in the book, they have the picture of the work of art. And it was a dream I had in the 1980s. The same image, the same picture. The dream I had in the 1980s when I was, I was living with Beth, and I had a dream that I was killed on a plane crash. And I landed in a park, and a woman, a beautiful woman, came up to me with this veil on, and she explains to me that I had died. And she tries to calm me down because I'm, of course, crying in my dream. And I said, but I have so many people I have to talk to, so many people I have to see. And she says, don't worry, time is different here. All the people you love will be here in a few minutes. Now, you can eat whatever you want. It doesn't matter. You don't have to eat at all. You can sleep. You can go visit the other people that are here. And I can describe the face of that woman from the 1980s on. And when I saw this painting from the 1400s, it was the same woman. And there was a man at her feet looking up to her, kind of in anguish, and she was explaining. And then Jung, in his description, was saying, this is a portrait of a short afterlife, someone who's passed away and encounters a female figure clothed like. And I'm going, this is what I had in the 80s. And so the idea of this season of the podcast is in terms of what is the nature of man. Stories that connect us to not only things that happen in our past, but are we motivated by things that have happened from the distant past that are beyond us? And are we in action creating a future that we are unaware of? So, but again, they're all true stories of TV shows and movies and love and life and children and heartbreak and triumph. Typical Tobolowsky file stuff, but with that Carl Jung sort of through line.
Well, yes, and with that incredible power of connections, and I guess regardless of whatever your belief system might be, a wonderful sort of symmetry to all of it.
Right, right. And the unexpected people that kind of come, I talk in some of the stories about my dreams and mention some of the dreams that prompted various events in my life. Some are highly regretful, but I found here's a brief example. I know it's from the story Ghost Rider, in that people ask me all the time, when did you become being a writer? And I thought, well, that's an interesting question. When did I become a writer? When did I become a professional writer? That was in college, because people hired me to write their papers for them. And so I would write, and I ended up writing master's theses and doctor's dissertations. I think I charged something like $400 for a master's thesis and $1,200 for a dissertation. And I would get writing samples from the people, and they would all ask me, they go like, well, you know, $400 is a lot of money. How good of a writer are you? And I said, that's not the question. The question is, how good of a writer are you? You see, I need 3 writing samples from you, and I'm going to try to imitate those writing samples and be as good as you are, but maybe just a little bit better. So the teacher will feel like they did a good job. And I tell the story of the beginning of my professional writing career, and I end up writing a play, and I'm not going to spoil this one. I end up writing a play as a master's thesis for someone who was looking for an education degree. And I said, well, you know, I'm in the theater, and I always wanted to be a playwright, so you have to promise me you will not produce this play. This play cannot be produced. You know, you can use it for the grade. That's fine. And then the story continues in a most unexpected way as to what happens when we do things in the past, what happens in the future. And the ripple effect, a simple negotiation, like writing a play in the past, can have on several people's lives in the future. That's one of my favorite stories, Ghost Rider.
And it's a wonderful, all I'll say is it's a wonderful payoff when things come back around.
Yeah, that it's for sure. And I have a lot of fans around the world with the Tobolowsky Files, and they're always on the internet trying to scope stuff out, because sometimes I don't give names. In Ghost Rider, I don't give real names of anybody. But I put the story out there, and I'll be damned. Some of these geniuses who have nothing but time on their hands on the internet went back and found evidence of this play.
Oh.
Found evidence of it in various newspapers.
Wow.
In various newspapers with photographs. Oh my God. I have to give a huge shout out to the Tobolowsky Files fans, because they are on me nonstop with BS detectors trying to see, because some of my stories are ridiculous, you know, but they're true. And I'd like to be kept honest for this. I really do.
You also brought back for me wonderful memories involving Pillsbury cinnamon rolls.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Pillsbury cinnamon rolls. Now, when I was a little boy, that was the Pillsbury. My mother made Pillsbury cinnamon rolls for us. I think Wednesday was cinnamon roll morning, and you could smell them as she was baking them in the oven. Now, the problem with the Pillsbury cinnamon rolls, as I recall, is, you know, it's a can of dough. It's this gooey tube of dough, and you pull them out and you stick them in a round pan, and then it has one little tin of sugar frosting you put on the top, and it melts. Oh, gosh, it's so good. But there are eight of them. There are eight cinnamon rolls, and we had three children in the family. So it became a real lesson in mathematics and also the unfair nature of our society. our sister, who was the youngest, was certainly going to get screwed. My brother Paul, older than me, he believed he was the oldest. He should get three cinnamon rolls because he is a growing boy. I believed I was the middle deprived child, so I was special. I should get three. And the Barbie was too young to really care. She should get the two. We learned that it don't work that way. And the entire family dynamic changed around the cinnamon rolls and my mother's solution to the cinnamon roll question. But here's another example that isn't in a podcast. It affected Anne. It affected my dear wife, Anne. And when she makes cinnamon rolls on Friday, she makes a number of cinnamon rolls for not only me and her, but she makes cinnamon rolls for our son, Robert, who now has a young one. I am a grandfather now.
That's right.
And so Robert and Dejanay, that's his wife, they come over with little Dior, and they take cinnamon rolls too. And Anne wants to make sure, because of the cinnamon roll story from the past, from, you know, I'm almost 70. So we're talking about 65 years ago, the cinnamon roll controversy. The cinnamon roll controversy has affected my wife, Anne, here in the present, and she wants no such no such bickering around our home. There will be cinnamon rolls for all, male, female, young, or old.
That's wonderful. Now, before we let you go, I would be remiss if I didn't ask about the squirrels. Are they back? Are they coming around still?
We do have squirrels. And we have, you know, we had the greatest squirrel in the world. Violetta right. was magnificent. I can't talk about her in glowing enough terms. She was a brilliant squirrel. She would come to our back door and lift her little head up and kind of look back and forth and look sad. And I would get a bag of nuts and put them on the bench. And she would very generously step back, not be weird squirrel behavior. Wait till all the nuts were dispatched onto that bench. Then I would close the door and she'd look at me and sort of, is it all right now? And then she would go up and feast on those nuts. Well, I think Violetta, we didn't see her for several months. So I figured she may have passed away. And it breaks my heart. But I think she has had children. Because now this year, during the pandemic, we have had baby squirrels, young squirrels come to the bench and they wait at the foot of the bench. And I'm going like, is this something she said on her squirrel deathbed in her squirrel sort of way saying, there is a feasting bench down by the house where the piano plays and the people seem to exercise for no reason at all. Wait by the window. And the big, big, tall thing will come out and give you nuts. And these little squirrels, they are the cutest things in the world. But there are squirrel wars. And they line up on the wall for me to put the nuts out on the bench. And the reason I think they are Violetta's children is that Violetta had a very special characteristic. Her left ear had a notch in it, had a little curled notch in it. These three little squirrels have the curly notch in their ear, too. And I think, like, could it be, Jung again, the generations passing wisdom on? I can finish off with this. There is something, Rich, I've read in the Talmud, and that is the greatest gift in the world is the blessing of two generations. The teachings of a grandparent to a grandchild is the most important lesson to keep civilization alive, because that length of time, that bridge of years, is what the ancient wise men 2,000 plus years ago thought was necessary to keep society healthy, vibrant, and alive. So to all the grand folks out there, the lesson of two generations, be careful what you teach. Be careful what squirrels you feed.
That's a great way to wrap it up. Stephen Tobolowsky on Downtown. Stephen, thank you. It's so good to talk with you. As always, our best to you and Anne, and we wish you well and hope to see you all on the other side of this whenever that happens.
Oh, thank you. And you know we'll be right on our way to Maine as soon as this is over.
All right. We've got a belt waiting for you when you get here.
I love it.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
Stephen Tobolowsky on Downtown.